This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
It's Wednesday, April the 3rd, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. We have something a little different this week. I'm delighted to be joined by David Reif. David is the author of many books, including two on the development of the modern American city. He's reported on war in Bosnia, on the political complexities of humanitarian and international intervention in sub-Saharan Africa, as well as on political developments in Central and South America. He also has a Substack newsletter in which he reflects on the progress of the current culture wars and their implications for international intellectual life. And as if that were not enough, he's currently spending about half his time in Kyiv, where he is observing the ongoing war against Russian aggression. I'm not sure, David, how much of this we're going to get through today, but you are very welcome to the podcast anyway.
Thanks for having me.
As I said, you're in Kyiv quite a lot at the moment, and I've seen you make a connection between what you're doing there and one of your first major foreign postings, which was during the war in Bosnia.
Yes, I wrote about very different subjects before I got to Bosnia in 92. I wrote two books about Cuban exiles and another book about immigration in LA, and then I wrote cultural pieces as well. And then I went to Bosnia really to do one story for the New Yorker magazine for which I wrote at the time. And I ended up staying 3 years and slightly changing careers so that after that I would regularly write and cover, whether as a proper journalist or as an essay writer or whatever, wars and humanitarian emergencies. But Bosnia was the only, I'm 71, and I really had not imagined I would be doing this at this age. I had already quit writing about war zones in 2004, which was when I was in Iraq, and then in Palestine, in Ramallah, at the very end of Arafat's rule. And I thought that was it. I'd gone on to write about Latin America, which is sort of where I start intellectually, outside my own family of my overbearing intellectual overseers, who are my parents.
We might come to that later.
Yeah, we can come to that if you like. But anyway, I thought I was done. So I did Latin American politics, and I have a life in Argentina. I mean, a private life. And so I'm back and forth to there all the time. And I did that. I did the Bolivian elections with Evo Morales. I did a lot of stuff about Mexico, where I lived when I was young, and some Cuba stuff. But then there'd been this just war that I'd experienced in Bosnia, where I really thought, whereas most wars are either conflicts between two bunches of swine, Sudan today is a pretty good example of that, or the lesser of evils, of which you can, where you'd say, well, this cause is just, even if the people supporting it are pretty bad.
Or there might be a balance. There can be ambiguity.
There's at least some ambiguity, exactly. Mm. So that I think sensible people who are sympathetic to Palestine are not, at least in their sane moments, sympathetic to Hamas, but they still might say the Palestinian struggle is just, even if, and the greater evil is Israeli colonization, whatever. I think most wars fall into that category, and they're only very rarely just wars, where I really think the morality is all on one side. It really is the kind of stuff that Catholic just war theory was made to tease out and explain.
And did you come to that conclusion in Bosnia,
yes,
or did you go to the war with that sense?
I knew nothing about Bosnia when I went. In fact, they had said to me, could you write something about Bosnia? And I said, I wrote them back. This was when Tina Brown was the editor of the New Yorker. I said, well, there's this ethnic cleaning. That was the state of my knowledge. I mean, I'd been in the former Yugoslavia as a tourist a few times. I didn't know Bosnia. Didn't know the language, never learned it properly. So I wasn't able to claim any kind of intimacy. But I was there, and I thought it was completely clear, which doesn't mean, just so your listeners are not, don't think I'm a complete idiot, that war isn't about the slaughter of innocents, even when it's a just war. I mean, I would never claim that the Bosnian government, or the Ukrainians, for that matter, whom I also think are waging a just war, the only one I've seen, and only one of four I can think of in my lifetime. Of course, war is about the slaughter of innocents. War corrupts. War makes, gives vile people in every society power they shouldn't have. War damages everything. So again, to say just war isn't to say glorious war.
So accepting all of that, I mean, there are some parallels between what happened in the Balkans in the 1990s and what's happening now. You had a large multi-ethnic state with a dominant power within it. You had a sort of an attempt at nation formation when that state collapsed. And you had a reaction, ultimately a military reaction against that attempt at nation formation. And I suppose in a way, on a much larger scale, that's exactly what's happening between Russia and Ukraine now.
To some extent, I don't think I'd go that far, to be honest. I think that Ukraine has been trying to become independent since the 17th century, at least. I mean, some people would put it much further back, but I get very suspicious of people talking about nation states before the early modern period. I mean, it seems to me that the oldest nation in Europe is France, and you can't really talk about French, the French nation, until you talk about the French, a version of the French language, but you can't talk about the French nation until the 1600s, really, I think, or maybe the late 16th century, 15th century, sorry. So, you know, when people talk about medieval this, whether it's Putin talking about Rus and Prince Rurik and that, or for that matter, the Ukrainians talking about the Scythians and whatever, I'm very skeptical. But I think since the beginning of the 1600s, Ukraine has been consciously trying to become independent. You can't say that about Bosnia, which was just this corner of the Ottoman Empire that the Austrians then got. And you can't say it to the extent you could say it about Croatia. And to some extent, I mean, the mistake in Yugoslavia, retrospect laid the seeds for what finally happened in the 90s was the fact that the Croats didn't want to be part of the first Yugoslavia in 1918.
I suppose you could say it about Ireland as well. I mean, I look at some of these things through the prism of the essays of Hubert Butler, who wrote quite a lot from an Irish perspective about the small countries of Central and Eastern Europe. And I mean, when I say nation formation, I talk about a process which I think you're quite right. It goes back to the 16th or 17th centuries, but it really takes off in the 19th century when there is an attempt to. And I'm interested to ask you about this because you've written a book about being in praise of forgetting. And a lot of people are very fond of history and they might get upset by that idea, but it's a very cogent argument that you make in that. But what's being forgotten a lot of the time is stories, some of which are rooted in truth and some of which were just purely made up at some point between 1850 and 1900. That's true of Ireland as it is of other countries.
Oh, of course it's true. Well, it's true of every country. I mean, Ernest Renan, the 19th century French historian and political thinker whose book on nationalism still is the most comprehensive teasing out of what a nation state is, you know, said, You left out all the bad bits when you were constructing national feeling. You didn't say that, you know, that all these massacres had been done by your side. You said you were the victims of all the terrible massacres, but you yourself were blameless. And that's how you make a national myth. I mean, the cultural crisis in the West is partly because these national myths don't persuade a whole lot of the elite anymore. They just don't see it. I don't think that's true in Ireland, but it's certainly true in the UK and the US and Canada and Australia. The rest of what the conservative writer David Frum calls the Anglosphere. But yes, of course, the myths are, it's the 19th century. I mean, Romanticism and nationalism, I mean, the movements, the cultural movement of Romanticism in the 19th century and the and nationalism, particularly in the Eastern European and Italian, perhaps Irish versions as well, are completely intertwined. I mean, I think that's probably, I mean, certainly if you look at the Risorgimento, you know, it can't be separated from the Romantic movement in Italian culture. And it's certainly true in Poland. And in some ways, Ukraine is a less powerful, less coherent version of what, Ukrainian nationalism in the 19th century has many resemblances, except the Polish version was much more coherent.
So does that mean that there's something happening in Ukraine now? I read a lot of stuff about young Ukrainians who come from Russian-speaking backgrounds making a choice to be Ukrainian speakers first and foremost, and other things which are part of that kind of a national formation, for want of a better use. You know, people deciding which side they're on and where their allegiance is, and perhaps changing, you know, under duress because of what's happened.
Huge changes, and absolutely under duress. I mean, the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, campaigned, and it was only 2019, so it's four or five years ago, I don't remember when the elections were held, on a program of making the Russian-speaking minority feel more comfortable. He was the, I wouldn't say he was the anti-national candidate, but he was the one who wanted the most compromise of the, three candidates standing for with Russia, with Russian culture, with the Russianness, cultural, I'm talking about, obviously not geographical or political, but of Eastern and Southeastern Ukraine. And a friend of mine in Kiev, who's very nationalist, but once said to me, Ukraine is very good at revolution and very bad at consolidation. And historically, in the 30-odd years of independence, 33 years of independence, I think that it's Russian glide bombs and Iskanders and Kinshal missiles that have made this change. I know many, many people in Ukraine who didn't speak Ukrainian with each other much at home. People tell you that even 10 years or 12 years ago in Kiev, for example, in the capital, that speaking Ukrainian was viewed as a kind of lower class thing to do. There are all kinds of books that only exist in Russian that were published long after independence. I mean, I'm not talking about, obviously, the holdovers from Soviet times. And so it really was Putin's bombs. I mean, Putin seems, I mean, look, I'm a fairly gloomy person. I'm very much a glass half empty kind of person, but I don't think you have to be a pessimist to feel very frightened for the Ukrainians at this moment. The Americans have screwed up big time in terms of the military aid. Europe is not producing enough munitions to fill the gaps, at least not yet. Perhaps they will in summer. And in the meantime, the Russians have gotten their military act together, unfortunately. And so the Ukrainians are very much on the defensive. And the question only is how bad it'll get before, hopefully, a lot of weapons come in, the F-16s from Denmark and the Netherlands and other things that might be able to stabilize things on the
battlefield. So there's a 3 to 6 month window now where the Russians have an opportunity.
That three terrible months. The best case scenarios that you hear in Brussels and among people who know something about European military affairs is that it'll be in June that big amounts of what the Ukrainians need, not everything, of course, will be available. And I think that's right. But in terms, having said all that, if you look at what Putin has accomplished, he has consolidated Ukrainian nationalism and made a great many people who considered themselves culturally, at least binational and perhaps even Russian, move to what had been more the position of the Ukrainian right, which was Ukrainianness, the Ukrainian language, Ukrainian authors, Ukrainian music, et cetera, et cetera. And he revived NATO, which was in the process of falling apart because it had no mission. And both of these things, and the remilitarization of Europe, you could say, I would say, I made this argument, but I think it's right, that one of the inscribed on the DNA of the European Union was the idea that, largely speaking, it doesn't mean Europe had become pacifist, that would be unfair, but largely speaking, Europe could exercise tremendous soft power without having much hard power. And I don't mean that in the Trumpian sense that the Americans were paying the bills, the kind of stuff that Trump always says. And,
free riding.
I don't mean it that way. I mean literally that they thought they could exercise real soft power. And partly that has to do with the, you know,
The German history.
Partly it has to do with the fantasy that war was an atavism and we were going to go toward less and less war, which the statistics bore out. There's this institute in Stockholm, SIPRI, that charts these things. And you, if you look at the curve from 1950 or anyway, 1960, let's say, to 2001, it's all down. There are fewer wars. There are fewer dead, although that's slightly more complicated than it looks at first glance. And you have mostly civilian casualties. That is, you know, the collateral damage of wars, the military euphemism has it.
Not much consolation to the people who were in them, though. I do wonder, I mean, if the Ukrainian war aims seem to me, correct me if I'm wrong, seem to be very hard to achieve, the reassertion of completely of national sovereignty over the borders. Mind you, Putin's war aims, which he's careful not to over-specify, but they seem to include, you know, leaving Ukraine essentially as a puppet state and perhaps just, you know, acquiring territorial gains for the Russian Empire.
Partition with Poland,
as well.
You know, yeah. instead of Nazi Germany, they'll split it with the Poles. Mm. I don't certainly think this Polish government would opt for that. On the other hand, if Ukraine collapsed altogether, would NATO permit a Russian army at the Polish border with control of Lviv? I doubt it. I think Putin's project is to restore some version of the empire, whether you call it the Soviet space, whether you call it Peter the Great and his successor's ambitions. And I certainly think if Ukraine were to lose, which of course I pray it does not, that he'll go for Kazakhstan and for Moldova, or at least Transnistria, and that the Baltics might well find themselves, maybe not invaded, but certainly blockaded. Mm. And I think he's perfectly in earnest. I tend to believe people when they talk. You know, history suggests that most politicians, particularly dictatorial politicians, say more or less what they mean. I mean, there's lots of stuff they don't say, self-evidently. But whether Ukraine, it's very hard to imagine them taking Crimea back. Whether they know that, whether they can face it, I don't know. And maybe I'm wrong, you know, I mean, it's possible that if that Russia's badly defeated on the battlefield, that things change. I mean, you never know. But of course, the odds are against it. However, they can't say that. I mean, they have to. I mean, their claim is that these are legitimate borders recognized by everybody, including Russia in 1991. And that if they were to say, well, you know, we can't do that, well, then surely the next step is to say, well, if you can't do that, what about the Donbass? And what about, why should your claim to any of it be agreed to if this claim for Crimea is dismissed?
But if at the point, as inevitably will arrive at some stage where some form of talks have to take place and a compromise by its nature is grubby and the questions will always arise, you know, was it for this that people died? This awful, grubby compromise that sells us down the river, that becomes very difficult, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And there'll be a lot of bitterness, whatever happens, particularly in Ukraine, because the Ukrainians are, you know, they are losing their best and brightest at a terrible rate. You know, there's a Russian elite officer corps, and they're getting killed in quite substantial numbers. But Russia has caught these conscripts from the poorer Asiatic republics of the Russian Federation. They have a lot of mercenaries from all over the place who they just throw in, and these people get killed in 2 minutes. And the prisoners, the convicts who get let out of jail if they're willing to fight. So, I mean, Western military people tell you that probably 3 Russians are getting killed by for every Ukrainian, but that math is very unfavorable to Ukraine because they can't afford. Also, as a society, I mean, you're talking about, you go to, I'm connected now to a university in Kyiv. And so when I go in to give my little classes and things, you pass a wall full of graduates and faculty and administration staff who've been killed since the Donbass war started in 2014. And every time I go back to Ukraine, which is every third or fourth month for about a month or 5 weeks, there are more faces. But that, if you went to Moscow State University, I guarantee you there'd be very few faces of faculty, staff, or students who would be on the wall because they're not the ones doing the fighting. I mean, they got killed at that terrorist attack in suburban Moscow the day before yesterday, whenever it was. But so, yeah, you're also right to say all wars end. And usually all wars end bitterly. That's say bitterly for the Ukrainians will feel cheated. Of course they will. You know, one of the things I do in Ukraine is I try to level with people in a way I feel a great many of their supporters don't do to their faces. What many supporters of Ukraine say to each other is very different from what they say to Ukrainians. And I'm, you know, Cassandra is a role that suits me fine. And, or Eeyore maybe. But if I'm being less grandiose, but I tell them, you know, you know, Russia is not going to be reformed. You're going to be facing the same people who are killing you now. And they'll be quite unrepentant because this war is fine with the Russians. Most of the people, the opinion maker sort of people, either are not affected directly by it and are afraid, or have gone into exile or just moved abroad for however long. You go to Dubai, for example, nowadays, or Abu Dhabi, and it's full of Russians, prosperous Russians, who have apartments there and the rest of it. So if they think there'll be some vindication, but again, we're all consumed in, certainly in the West, maybe globally, by these progress narratives. Maybe one of the most eloquent formulations was Martin Luther King's when he said the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. And that's the traditional Christian in his case, but it could be Marxist or even liberal in the UK sense, not the continental European sense. I don't think that's true myself, but leaving aside whether or not I think it's true as a general rule, in some ways, who cares what I think? I certainly don't think it's going to bend toward justice for Ukraine.
Your skepticism would also be shared, I think, by many people looking at that conflict from the global south. And the Ukraine conflict has become yoked in geopolitical terms and in the popular imagination, I think, in a way with what's happening in Gaza. You can see that in the United States House of Representatives, you can see it in the comparisons that people make. And that accusation, which is not a new one, of Western hypocrisy, of claiming to uphold certain liberal values and human rights when it suits the West's geopolitical ends and not when it doesn't.
Yes, and it's, to some extent, it's true. I mean, that there's hypocrisy about Israel-Palestine, that's undeniable. My own view is that, for what it's worth, is that I never have justified my support for Ukraine any more than I did my support for Bosnia in terms of fundamentally human rights or humanitarian terms. Because if you do that, then indeed the critics in the global South, and indeed some here in the global North, are correct that the worst human rights abuses are not in Ukraine. The worst humanitarian disaster in the world is certainly not in Ukraine. It's Sudan by a far length, and it may even be, the next one may be DRC, not Gaza. I would argue it is.
I saw somebody pointing out there was a war between Ethiopia and Tigray only 3 or 4 years ago. There's more than 100,000 people died in that.
Exactly.
If you ask most people on the street about that, they wouldn't have a clue.
Yeah. And that's the, because that, yes, is there Western hypocrisy over Gaza v. Ukraine? Yeah. But there's also leftist hypocrisy over Gaza v. Africa, which I think is, if one is unforgivable, so is the other. My own view is the justification of supporting Ukraine is political, not humanitarian, that it is in the interests of certainly of the West, but probably of more than the West, that the Russian Empire not reconstitute itself. And that seems to me can only be achieved with Ukrainian victory, because the Ukrainians are the people who are most, however difficult the situation is, they could win. Could Kazakhstan win against Russia? If you watch Russian television, there's talk about Kazakhstan. They're de-Russifying, they're favoring the Kazakh language. We can't permit that for our minorities. And, you know, we've heard that in many contexts, and certainly heard that in the Balkans. Milosevic rose to power saying that about Serbs in other parts of Yugoslavia. But of course, if you're talking in purely humanitarian terms, then absolutely. I just think the West has the right to defend itself against a direct threat to itself. I mean, I don't think that it's a crime to be particularist in, or regionalist, let's say. I don't expect someone in Japan, I mean, I don't agree with people like Bernard Hillevy or Anne Applebaum or Tim Snyder, that the fate of global democracy depends on the outcome in Ukraine, because I'm also somebody who spent a lot of time in my life in the global South and still do. And I also know that, for example, in Asia, why should people be that concerned? It's not going to affect them seriously. Is the democratic, let take an example, that the democratic destiny of India will be decided in India in the debate between Hindutva and Congress, liberal socialism or social democracy, whatever you want to call it. Nothing that happens in Ukraine will affect that. And I think you could say the same about many other places in Asia. I don't believe I don't think everybody has to care about everything. What I do think is that there's a lot of feeling in the global South that if the United States is for something, it must be bad. Hence, somehow Putin can make these declarations in Addis Ababa, in the various fora he holds with African leaders and leaders from other parts of the world, where he talks about a new, juster world order. So, and they're willing to give him a pass. I think it's, to some extent, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. To another extent, it's the terrible history of the West in oppressing other peoples, which is, I suppose, where Gaza comes in. But again, even Gaza going to affect someone in India? Well, the government of India is very pro-Israeli because of anti-Muslim feeling. But I don't know. I think there's a lot of hypocrisy, enough hypocrisy to go around. Again, Latin America too. You know, there are Jews and Arabs. There are a lot of Jews in Argentina. There are a lot of Palestinians in Chile. Quite a few, both in Brazil. They are engaged, but the course of Argentine or Chilean politics or Brazilian politics, the future of these countries is not going to be determined by either crisis.
So what, I mean, I'm particularly interested in your view on this because people will know, will have gathered from your conversations so far, you're intimately acquainted with the politics of a lot of very different countries around the world. And you just mentioned Latin America there. And it seems to me that the broader picture is this shift to a more uncertain, more multipolar world to succeed the brief unipolar moment which existed for less than 20 years after the end of the Cold War. And we really don't know, like, we have pictures in our heads about the China-US conflict. We have the possibility of American isolationism. Maybe the idea of the West, as we understand it, begins to change. And Europe needs to think about itself as a singular entity in a way it hasn't had to do since 1945. All these things throw a huge amount of uncertainty into the mix, do they? And maybe they also account to some extent for the uncertainty you see in Western democracies as well about their future.
Yeah, I would say a couple of things to that. The first is that the failure of establishment parties in Europe to deliver, which now turns out we thought there were a few exceptions like this country and like Portugal. But in fact, it turns out that Sinn Féin may win next time here, and the Portuguese right has reestablished itself with great vigor. So I think that the middle class is no longer, and the lower middle class particularly, is no longer convinced that these establishment parties have anything to offer them. So the political crisis, it seems to me, in considerable measure can be attributed to that, to the, and other issues like immigration. But I think the remilitarization of Europe is a done deal. I think the wheels have been set in motion, and rather like, you know, the train schedules that are supposed to have caused the First World War to become inevitable at a certain point. I think European remilitarization is inevitable. The only question in my mind is whether it stays within the NATO frame or whether Europe creates a parallel military structure the way the French have proposed over the decades now and again, but which seems to have...
That might depend on what happens with America, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. But America, the United States is a very unreliable friend these days, as the Ukrainians are finding out, alas. There's a Washington... There's gridlock, and there is the... You know, this anarchic figure who's appeared on the scene, Trump, who, there have been figures like Trump in American history, but they've never become president. And there's Huey Long in the U.S. in the 30s in Louisiana, who was a real threat to Roosevelt before he was assassinated. And it was thought might have actually challenged him. There were the socialists in 1912. But largely speaking, there was a kind of consensus about, at least since 45, and since America's rise to preeminent global hegemony, post-Bretton Woods, post the decline of the British Empire, bankruptcy of Britain, in comparative terms anyway. So that's over. And Europe may well have to find its way. And I do think, I also think we're just going back to, we've had 75 years off of real life. We've had a period when it looked like the human rights revolution really was going to change the way people thought about the world. We've had, you know, the age of rights, as various people called it. And of course, the decline of war, or the relative decline of war. Again, the global South, you know, if you lived in Ethiopia,
you wouldn't think
war had declined. On the contrary, no. You'd probably think it had gotten worse in the post-World War II period than before. I mean, there were the Italians, to be sure, but and DRC has never had a moment's peace since the Belgians came, or Leopold came. They said 10 million people died then. I think that we're back to what the British jurist, 19th century British jurist Sir Henry Maine said, which was that war, not peace, is the norm in human history. And I think we're going back to that. And Europe thought it was exempt, or it had exempted itself, and that the world would follow the European model, that France and Germany had warred with each other for 1,000 years or whatever. You know, that's the rhetorical way it's put. And it's inconceivable that France and Germany could ever go to war again. And so if that can be true of France and Germany, why not? Why can't it be true of the whole world? And is there a certain European arrogance in that? Sure. But it's also understandable. It seems, if you were someone born in 1920, the Europe of 1964 must have seemed miraculous to you, impossible to have imagined, just as human rights justifications for things seemed unimaginable until they happened. But I don't think they've held, and I think the whole system is, largely speaking, either collapsing or collapsed. And I think even the most eloquent defenders of the age of human rights, I think of the Canadian writer and politician Michael Ignatieff, would have really cut back their expectations pretty radically.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
And you're welcome back. I want to give you the opportunity to give our listeners the full benefit of your Cassandra and Eeyore tendencies before we wrap it up. And you mentioned your parents earlier on, and you were very much a product of the high intellectual elite of the second half of the 20th century. Your mother was Susan Sontag, who's a very, very prominent name within cultural and critical circles during that time. You have a Substack at the moment, in which it seems to me you're observing and commenting on the kind of the collapse of that world.
Yeah, I think it's Cyril Connolly said prematurely, but not wrongly, it's closing time in the gardens of the West. Another way of putting it is a phrase that Arthur Miller used, which is when a culture is finished when it's outgrown its own myths. And it seems to me we see evidence of that everywhere. And then I think, look, at the risk of channeling not my inner Eeyore or my inner Cassandra, but my inner Clive James, or Milan Kundera maybe, I think what our era is culturally is an era of kitsch, in Kundera's very precise definition, which was that kitsch is when you feel better about yourself for having an opinion, a given opinion. So if you like, I don't know, whatever, something, and it you feel more virtuous for the liking of it, it's a kind of cultural narcissism.
And the verb to like means something different now because it means pressing a button on a social media platform.
Yeah, it also means, you know, reduction of attention span. It's harder for young people. High culture is really hard, most of it, not all of it. I mean, I don't think The Marriage of Figaro is hard, but most of it's hard. Proust is hard. Joyce is hard. And people don't want that. People want frictionless accessibility, which, by the way, is far more important than woke, it seems to me, is what the web offers in so many ways. And the model of frictionlessness, which is the commercial model, where you say, why would you have conflict? You want to sell the most to the most people. And you certainly don't want anything getting in the way of this consumer world. So in that sense, high culture, the high culture in which my father was fairly well-known, very conservative, oddly enough, sociologist who wrote several books about some of these questions. He anticipated, actually. He wrote a book called The Triumph of the Therapeutic, which is precisely about the victory of therapeutic culture, as he understood it. This book was written 50 years ago, over previous forms of high culture. But I think the model is this model of ease on the one hand and easily acquired virtue on the other. So
there is a political aspect to it.
Sure. But the political aspect is only vis-a-vis high culture. It's woke, for example, threatens nothing in the economic order. Nothing whatsoever. On the contrary, if anything, you could argue it's good for business. Markets, say more markets, different, you know, more boutique tastes, market segmentation of a more profitable kind. Everyone gets their own holiday, so you can make your trans doll and you're this doll and you're that doll and sell a lot of them. So why isn't that good for business? Why should you care about, I mean, that's the sort of tragedy of right-wing capitalists. They feel so betrayed, as if capitalism was supposed to, you know, also be right-wing. And, you know, that the great American sociologist Daniel Bell said long ago in his, that you had this situation on the right where they would praise capitalism for the first half of the speech, and then they would denounce all the inevitable social effects of capitalism in the second part of the speech and not see the contradiction. And I think we're there. And that's why it seems to be business has, and the managerial class that constitutes it, its workers, has absolutely embraced all this stuff, because why not? Why shouldn't it be easy? You don't want a taste that you have to learn in anything. You want things that are immediately pleasurable or make you feel immediately good or whatever. And that's where we are. But that's completely immiscible with high culture, because high culture is precisely about friction.
So it's Brave New World, not 1984?
Oh, much more. Absolutely. No, I'm convinced that I've written about Huxley in this Substack of mine. I'm absolutely persuaded he had it much more right than Orwell did. Orwell seems very sort of clunky and outdated. Where's the Huxley book for all? Obviously, it's ways in which, you know, the style he wrote it in and the rest is very much of its time. And some of the fantasies, like actually drugging people, is he was naive about how one could drug people. He thought you actually needed drugs.
We understand endorphins a lot more now than we did when he was writing. We're going to have to wrap it up, but just to say, if people want more of your dystopian realism, there is a book coming out of the Substack writings.
Yeah, the Substack is called Desire and Fate, and the book will have the same name. It's published by a small publisher in the UK called Eris, but it's distributed both here and in the UK.
That's out later this year.
It's out in the summer sometime. I'm not quite sure when. And the Desire and Fate, just for the amusement of your orders, or maybe amusement, maybe something worse, comes from a line of the great Marxist scientist Desmond Bernal, British scientist Desmond Bernal, who said, there's the history of desire and the history of fate, and man's reason has never figured out how to distinguish between the two. And that's where I think we are.
David Reif, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. Thanks very much to our producers, Declan Conlon and John Casey, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We'll be back with you very soon indeed. But until then, thank you very much for listening.